And welcome to AFPT Comics Podcast, episode 48. This is the comic book podcast where we talk about comic books, we review comic books, we interview comic books people.
We interview the comics themselves.
We do. Actually, every week when we review a comic, we're technically interviewing the comic. And we're like, is the pace good? Was the color good? I don't know. You tell me. My name is David Brook. I'm here with Forrest Hollingsworth. Hey, Forrest, how are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Pretty good.
I am excited to talk about comics this week.
Yes. Are you going to be talking about comics on Thanksgiving?
I'm going to talk about comics on Thanksgiving.
Really?
Yeah, I'm going to talk about Thanksgiving comics. Turkey comics, as we call them. The turkey books.
When you break bread and you, what is that? The wishbone. Do you ever make a wish for comics related questions?
I lost the plot of this so fast. Like, what?
So this show premieres on Sunday, but in 4 days, it's Thanksgiving, if you're in the United States, I suppose, or if you celebrate it. Or if you celebrate Friendsgiving, it'll be on Thursday too, right? Friendsgiving is the same as Thanksgiving, same time, same place.
Same time, same place, yeah.
So anyway, enjoy your Thanksgiving when you listen to this. Actually, I recommend you turn this on while eating Thanksgiving dinner. It is recommended for good digestion.
For good health, yeah. It's just good digestion. I don't know that I like the implication. This week is a little pre-Thanksgiving gift to y'all, though. We do have... Yeah. Writer Tim Seeley and artist Dan Fraga from the new He-Man and the Masters of the Multiverse.
Yes, they're on to talk about the new series as well as play a game with us, another super fight edition. And just break down He-Man. And also we find out Tim Seeley is a humongous He-Man fan.
Yeah, I was blown away by some of that stuff. Untranslated German plays.
Yes, like, yes. They're deep diving deep. Dive. Into the multiverse of He-Man. And, you know, when we asked him, like, hey, how much research do you have to do? He was like, zero.
My life is research. I've been doing it for 42 years. Yeah, it's a good interview. I hope folks like it.
Yeah, if you hang on, it'll be later in the show. Before we get to that, though, let's talk about the news. The biggest news of the week, comics-related news of the week. Yes, that's right. So prepare yourselves. Okay, maybe get a little extra gravy on the turkey right now. Go ahead. Okay, good.
It's like a weird quasi-ASMR.
So in the first bit of news, anyone like Ultraman? I used to watch it when I was little, actually.
Did you really?
Live action? Yeah, I did. Marvel Comics has struck a partnership with Japanese media company Tsuburaya Productions to create a new Ultraman comic book for American markets. Fascinating. We already know there are Ultraman manga. I believe Viz Media does those manga. But comic books... This is interesting because now we're blending Japanese characters that are traditionally usually, you know, manga or anime, and now American comics. How do you feel about this, Forrest?
I think it's weird. I don't know. I guess that I do know that they're doing the inverse of this in Japan right now, where they're releasing like Spider-Man manga and stuff like that, and they're releasing some other like Asian market specific things Marvel's doing right now. So the natural conclusion is that they would also want to bring popular properties over to America, I guess.
Oh, I didn't think of it that way. Yeah, but because they had like Arrow, that new series.
Yeah,
was actually being produced over there first, and now it's getting published here.
Swordmaster and Future First. Yep. They have a whole line of stuff that is like very explicitly about this kind of partnership. Mm-hmm. I just don't know that I personally don't know anything about Ultraman, aside from knowing that it's popular.
He's really big. He gets, like, as big as a skyscraper.
Oh. I thought you meant he's really big, like, he's popular.
No. Do you think they're going to have Spider-Man interacting with Ultraman, or will it be his own thing?
I hope so.
Interesting.
I hope so.
Maybe they'll give him a new origin where, like, Mr. Fantastic, like, goes to some other dimension and brings him in.
Yeah.
And then we could have the Power Rangers if they can work something out with Boom. There you go. Yeah. You know, screw it. Let's just make all the properties of everything combine into one.
Right. One giant conglomeration.
I mean, it's going to happen eventually.
Surely
when Disney
no
buys
one
all
would
the
do
companies.
That. Buy everything up and put it all on one platform.
Monopolies are good for you. Just like that cranberry sauce. Go get that. Yeah. A little more extra. In our next bit of news, Batman number 85 will now include a 2-page prelude of an incoming writer, James Tynion IV's new run. So we're going to get a little bit of extra Tynion in our life in Batman number 85, an unexpected addition. It looks like DC's adding sort of a prelude, two issues story, so that we get excited and extra pumped for when he takes over in January.
Yeah, two page story. At the end of this, that leads directly into Batman 86, which is mm-hmm. where he's taking over. So I kind of like that they're doing a seamless transition like that. I think it's neat.
Yeah, it makes sense. It does make me wonder, like, are they worried the Tom King fans are going to be like, oh, I'm done. I'm done when he's done.
Maybe. I think I took it more as an indication that there's going to be kind of a through line from King to Tinian's run.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's the same version of Batman
or something.
Instead of being like, we're going to completely reboot and renumber this.
Right. Yeah. Don't worry. Just because Bane dies and breaks Batman's back and Alfred's corpse is used as a gravy in the end of your series, Tinian does have somewhere to go with this. Oh, my God. I just spoiled it. Sorry. I read all the scripts early. Sorry.
We have talked about them putting out solicits and covers and all sorts of that stuff way too early.
Yeah.
This kind of accentuates that issue to me.
Mm.
Like, how cool would it have been if they just put this in there?
Oh, and then didn't tell us, you mean?
Right.
Yes.
If you just, like, King's story ends, there's an all-black page or something.
Yeah.
And then you start with Tinian's book, two pages into Tinian's book.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone would be talking about that.
Yeah, because it'd be a special surprise.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think they trust their audience enough.
To
do stuff like that. And that's unfortunate. It's probably born out of stuff about the market and criticism and purchases and retailer buying and all that stuff that I don't really understand.
Yeah.
But everyone fucking popped off about when Walking Dead did that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Set the world aflame, a fire.
Right. Yeah. Trust your audience. Trust them.
Well, it sounds like in our next bit of news, Aftershock Comics is going to make comic shops trust them more. They're offering new commitments in the new year to, I guess, help create a better bond between comic shops and Aftershock Comics. A couple of the things they're doing includes a commitment to solicits of new projects only once the first issues of the series are completed. So they're saying to the comic shops, you should totally buy in because we're not even going to put these books out until we have two issues in hand. So things won't get delayed.
And a third issue scripted.
Yes. Right.
So,
and then they're also doing a buyback program similar to other publishers so that if they don't sell all their copies, they can get comic book shops can get some of their money back if they're not flying off the shelf. What else? Number one issues will feature four additional pages of relevant content, as well as cardstock covers for $4.99 to increase the price so they can get a little more coin. So basically they're trying to, like, I don't know, make comic shops a little more warm and fuzzy around them.
Incentivized to buy into their series.
Yeah? Yep.
If you chart out, and I know they're not the same production company, like it's not one-to-one or whatever, but if you look at like the Image series, that dipped after Walking Dead.
Yeah.
Like, no one was buying Image books. And, like, it was really only recently that Charles Soule and Snyder book, Undiscovered Country,
sold out.
Really got people to buy in again.
Yeah.
Second printing. And that probably would have been even stronger if they had been like, we got the first five issues done or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just, well, DC and Marvel are flooding the market.
Yeah.
It's a really hard value proposition to say, retailers need to buy into these indie books when they might make it to four or whatever issues. It's wasted time. It's wasted funds. And I think for Aftershock, they're also seeing it as potentially wasted distribution.
Yeah.
You know, I don't track Aftershock series that frequently, but maybe they've had artists, colorists, writers, whoever, creators, just kind of drop off books.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not good for Aftershock, and it's also not good for retailers, so I think Aftershock is making a really, really good faith effort here to say, please engage with us.
It definitely also shows that probably a large chunk of their sales is in comic shops and not necessarily on Comixology or whatever.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think we've talked in the past about how not enough publishers respect the direct market.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because it's still alive.
Talk about disrespecting the direct market. DC Comics has a lot of shakeups. Harleen, number three is postponed 3 weeks. Legion of Superheroes, number two, is pushed back 2 weeks. DC's canceled the third Damage collection. But In positive news, Batman Curse of the White Knight number 5 comes out a week early. This is largely probably because they had the Mr. Freeze one-shot that came out this week, and likely they were just kind of creating a little space between them, but they were like, why don't we just put it out?
Yeah.
So that's a lot of shakeups. The response to that
Von Freeze book was really, really warm.
What is?
The response to that Von Freeze one-shot. Mm. Yeah, did really well.
Yeah, I had an interesting story connecting to, you know, Nazis and Jewish folks trying to get out and stuff like that. And it was deeply personal to Sean Murphy, too. There's a nice letter in the end where he kind of explains himself. So what's the deal, DC? Why are we moving things around? Why are we canceling things? Why are we pushing? Well, not we are canceling. We are pushing dates around. This isn't helping the comic shops.
No, as alluded to, they're flooding the market, but they can't get them out consistently.
Yeah.
You're going to see more publishers like Aftershock take advantage of this.
Yeah, that's true.
Because Marvel and DC are doing this a lot.
Yeah, if you can position your book.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, if you can position your book and you and the comic shop knows it's coming out the 18th, you can prepare better, right? You can put up more marketing materials and stuff and get people more jazzed for it before it even hits the shelf.
I mean, the second and third issues of the new Deadpool book are pushed back.
Yeah.
Like 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Or something. Marvel and DC are doing this. I think it's much more directly a DC problem. Marvel's problem is that they cancel a series before they can prove themselves.
Right.
But DC, is Doomsday Clock out?
The last issue?
Yeah.
No, the preview went up this week, though. It comes out December 18th.
So it definitely exists.
Yes. And it will come out December 18th, according to them.
But 5 years after it was supposed to.
It's over.
That's
2 years.
That's an exaggeration.
Yeah.
It's an exaggeration, but it has been at least a year.
2 years. 2 years it's supposed to be. I guess that you're right. 1 year overdue. You're right.
That's bonkers.
It is crazy.
That's bonkers.
It was a 12 issue series once a month, and they couldn't do it.
That's like a flagship book that people are still going to buy into when it comes out. You're still putting it out because Doomsday Clock is actually doing really well when the issues actually come out.
Yep.
But Harleen, Legion of Superheroes, those books don't have as much buy-in from an audience yet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, cable TV had this problem all the time.
Cable TV?
They move shows to Saturday nights.
Oh, uh-huh.
Or but this episode's out on Thursday morning.
Right.
You know, and that's kind of a big part of binge culture.
Mm-hmm.
What has become binge culture is that audiences don't want that. They want to be able to watch a show and know when it comes out consistently.
Yeah, it's usually a death knell of a show when they're like, it's on Wednesdays, but now we're moving it to Saturday.
right. And how we're conditioned to feel the same way about comics.
Right.
It's not a good look.
No, yeah. And I mean, not to mention it affects the production of the collections too, right?
Right.
Because now the collection's not going to come out for 3 weeks.
Your whole publishing pipeline is clogged up with this shit.
Right.
And I don't think you can attribute to any one thing. I don't want to say all these creators are getting their checks and running. Or, you know, and it's not probably just all editorial. It's probably not all just distribution or whatever. But it seems like they really need to get a person, DC in particular, needs to get a person in here that's good at infrastructure.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole planning game. You know, the fact that they're not putting out the third collection for Damage
ever,
it kind of makes, this doesn't really happen anymore. It used to happen a lot more because, I mean, they weren't putting out collections as healthily as they do now.
Yeah.
But does this tell you something about DC's greenlining of things? Because, you know, I reviewed a couple of those Damage books and they weren't very good. And they felt very thrown together at the last second. It was basically Hulk, but in the DC universe in a lot of ways. And yet it got greenlit. It probably wasn't even selling that well. So maybe they were letting it continue on, even though it wasn't necessarily selling well. And then at this point, someone's like, no, we are not going to lose money on collections of this.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
How many listeners out there love Damage, hate me now, and are dying for this third collection that'll never come out? Let us know in the comments.
Dozens.
In our next bit of news, Marvel Comics is putting out the very first Braille comic book inspired by a football player who is blind. So this is part of the Marvel's Hero Project, which is a documentary on Disney Plus. And they're not putting out a lot of physical Braille comic issues, in part because I think it's quite expensive to put these out. Not to mention, you can't just, I mean, Braille requires more space to actually be read compared to, you know, the written words. So it makes, there was a...
Yeah, the comic has to be completely structured around it.
Yeah. So yeah. What they ended up doing also was creating an online version where you can hear the language.
Yeah, I think it's Comixology that has like a guided voice mode as well, descriptive panels and stuff like that. So at least for some books. So I think that that's probably how most visually impaired people are consuming comics these days.
Mm-hmm.
But also like the tactile feel of a Braille comic, or knowing that there is a bespoke Braille comic made for that community, is awesome.
Yeah.
Like that's really, really great. And it is very time and labor and cost intensive.
Right.
And I work in a department at a university that covers a lot of online learning and adaptive learning and emerging technologies and all that stuff. And we work a lot with screen readers and getting Braille materials made for visually impaired students. And like, it is not an insignificant task by any means.
Right.
So getting something like that prepared for mass distribution, I can't even imagine.
Yeah, and the story is quite uplifting. I mean, it's about this football player who lost his sight at 5 years old, but then went on to become a professional football player. And this story is about that journey.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So I'm curious to see how much more Marvel would do with this. I wonder if it's a one-off or not. I mean, obviously the, the sales aren't going to be there. They're not going to be making $1 million on this.
It bums me out that it just seems like such easy advertising for their Heroes Project TV show.
Yeah. Right.
But additionally,
you that's what it serves, well. You mean?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Like, but sometimes poorly intentioned things still mete out good for it, the consumer.
Right.
So, I don't know. We'll see how well it does. I hope it does very well.
Yeah. Next up, DC Rush solicits new Birds of Prey giant title. Because
speaking of commercials,
we got a movie coming. Oh my God. Why isn't there more of this on the shelf? No surprise there. I just thought I'd bring it up. Do you have any comments on that? Probably not. It's not a big deal.
No. I mean, I think it's weird that they still managed to put out that one shot, that Brian Azzarello one shot on Black Label.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I don't know, maybe there were competing pitches at the same time or something.
I am dying to see. They don't even have creators listed or story credit. It's literally like, just rushed to tell comic shops 16 days before the movie, you better order this so you have it on your shelf.
Oh my God. This is like when WWE books a team.
Yeah.
It's like Raw and SmackDown, and all the wrestlers are listed for those teams. And then, like, and NXT will be there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, check in that day to find out.
If I was a comic shop, I might order like a couple, but without knowing any of the creators or what the story is, like, why would I buy in?
This is the theme of this week, I guess, because Aftershock is like, yeah, why would you buy in?
Yeah, yeah.
To that.
I mean, I don't actually know the correlation between movies and comic sales, but from what I know historically, it's never that great. It's not like you...
The Infinity Gauntlet trade was the best-selling trade of last year.
Right, but nothing like new.
But that's extra... special.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. In other news, Loki quietly canceled. Interesting.
Yeah.
Daniel Kibblesmith was on this show a couple months ago now. We were talking about this very series. I kind of anticipated this would be canceled just because the buzz wasn't insane around it. It was a really well-written series, in my opinion. But
yeah, it's great. I liked it.
It's interesting that it was quietly canceled. It's like Marvel doesn't want it to come out that they're like axing it for a specific reason.
I think everything these days is inextricably tied to, like we were saying, film and TV.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got a Loki series coming to Disney Plus.
Yeah.
And they don't want to make it seem like Marvel doesn't have faith in Loki right before that show starts. You know? And so they're kind of quietly ending this series. Kibblesmith just wrote in a letter that it was the last issue.
Yeah.
And they're going to relaunch it right along the show. I guarantee you they will.
Oh, yeah. They'll have someone, probably not Kibblesmith, but someone else will be writing it.
Yeah. And the problem with that is that you don't get time for these creators and for the story arcs to develop naturally.
Mm-hmm.
You just get these like 5-issue bursts and they may be totally different takes on Loki. You know, one may align better with the TV show, one may not. It's hard to tell oftentimes what editorial is trying to do there.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't often dislike the series.
Yeah.
I just find the whole practice kind of confusing, though, because that's not how you build an audience.
I saw Matthew Rosenberg was answering fan questions on Twitter, and he had commented that buy Hawkeye, don't buy Hawkeye. No matter what happens, he's going to be able to tell his first story arc. If people buy it, he can continue. So it was an interesting perspective because it seemed like in his opinion, as long as I get to tell my first arc that I've planned, I'm happy. And maybe that's what happened here. I don't know.
I mean, maybe it sucks that that's how creators have to think about stories.
Yeah, yeah.
These days, but yeah. I mean,
if it doesn't sell, it doesn't sell.
Yeah, I like that they're still invested in it. I think that's great.
Yeah.
The creators, I mean.
So we usually devote a lot of time to the Marvel solicitations. We're not going to do that this week. But the Marvel
reader, you already know everything that's coming out.
Yeah. Per what we've talked about on the show a couple times now, Marvel has already pretty much revealed a lot of what is in their February solicitations before the February solicitations even came out. But they did come out on, I think it was Thursday this week?
I think that's right. Yep.
And was there anything that caught your eye that you were surprised by? I know there is some stuff in here that wasn't pre-revealed.
Dark Agnes.
Oh, yeah.
A new Becky Cloonan horror comic.
Yes.
Did not expect that to come from Marvel. And had not heard anything about it. But it seems like they're committed to 5 issues. So that's awesome.
Yeah. I think there might have been a reveal that was coming.
Really? It was off my radar almost completely.
There was some news like a month or two ago where Marvel was like sort of bragging that they're building out the Conan universe with more characters from Robert E. Howard's collection of stories, not Conan related. But yeah, that's pretty cool. I'm always excited for more Becky Cloonan. I was surprised by the noir Grimm story. Grimm noir. Did you see that?
Grimm noir.
Yeah.
Fantastic Four Grimm noir.
Yeah, by Jerry Duggan and Ron Garney.
Yeah.
They just recently wrapped up a pretty great story, Savage Sword of Conan story. So I think the art is going to definitely work for this kind of tale. That was a surprise for me.
Ben Grimm throws on his hat and overcoat. Cool. To solve a mystery that's come alive right out of his nightmares.
It's such a no-brainer. He's already got the clothes for it.
Yeah. He's a bespoke detective.
There's a bunch of 2020.
My other big takeaway was that...
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Go ahead. I thought Marvel's X looks awesome.
Yeah.
I like everything Ross is doing.
Yeah, yeah. I'm curious about that. I was a big Earth X fan. God, what was this, like 98? No, 2002.
Long time ago, you oldie.
I sold my entire collection on eBay, all the single issues in this giant box for like $50, but I didn't like put any packaging, and the guy was so mad because the comics were like destroyed by the time they got there. I was like, whatever, I've sold so much stuff on here, it doesn't matter if I get this bad score. Yeah, there's a bunch of 2020 tie-ins. It looks like they're either one-shots or two-issue arcs. Actually, Matthew Rosenberg is doing a Force Works that's 3 issues. We're going to get to the 2020 stuff in a bit, but...
And 2099.
Or, yeah, and 2029.
All
these
competing titles.
Why at the same time, though? God.
Let's take it to the segment. the only other thing was that I saw in the solicitations was a Chris Claremont... Wolverine story, Marvel Tales Wolverine, written by Chris Claremont. Oh, apparently I can't say the man's name.
Yeah.
You know who I'm talking about.
Yep.
And the cover art is by Frank Miller.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So it seems to me like into 2020, Marvel's still going to be leaning into this retro.
Yes, yes. We're past the 80th anniversary, but screw it. Let's just keep honoring the past.
Yeah. I mean, that was all guys anyway, right?
Yeah.
It seemed pretty obvious that they were just doing this for the bucks.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of bucks, though, Wolverine's at $7.99, a 72-page book.
Whoa.
Wowza. I wonder if that'll be in the top 5 selling books for money for that
for
month.
For profit, probably.
Yeah.
For copy sold, probably not.
That's a lot of money for the first. I hope it's good.
That's 3 indie comics.
Yeah, you're right. Anyway, yeah, there's a couple surprises in there. If you go to AIPTcomics.com, you can check out the full solicitations that are up. And yeah, there's some great cover art in there too.
And we're very proud of them. David worked a long time on them.
I did. I spent like an hour trying to put this together quickly.
You're practically a Marvel employee.
I am. You know, some days I feel like that. Especially recently, the PR guy at Marvel keeps sending me exclusives. And he's like, can you put this up in the next hour? I'm like, yes. We posted a bunch of exclusive this week. Exclusive cover reveals for Darth Vader. Or Star Wars, sorry. Yeah. Yeah, there's new Star Wars books coming out, too. There's a new Darth Vader book by Greg Pak starting in February.
I'm into it.
Yeah. You know what else you're into? Top books of last week, because you get to talk about the book that you liked the most. Two books, in fact. Every time we start this segment, we talk about comicbookroundup.com's number one critic and fan picks. This week, Once in Future number 4 gets a 9.2 from critics, and Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen number 5 gets a 9.7 from fans. Not surprising.
No, Once in Future doesn't surprise me at all. Anything Kieran Gillen's name on is going to sell like hotcakes.
Yeah.
Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen, I was thinking about this book recently. It's one of the few comics coming out today that I like, when I read it, I'm like, I understand why this exists as a comic book.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of comic books that we read today, not to say that I dislike them, but they feel to me like, okay, this could have easily been an episode of a TV show or a movie,
yeah,
or whatever. But Jimmy Olsen is doing so much with the lore of Superman and the medium of comics and kind of this retro nostalgia that I really get why it exists as a comic, which I sometimes struggle with for other books. So I'm glad to see it's doing well. And I bet a lot of people feel that way.
It's a very comic booky comic, one might say.
Yeah.
But what is your second favorite solid book of last week? Solid, not liquid.
My second favorite book of last week is He-Man and the Masters of the Multiverse number 1, written by Tim Seeley with art by Dan Fraga and Richard Friend, some of whom will be on later in this show.
Good plug.
When I read Spider-Verse and when I saw Spider-Verse, the movie,
yes,
I knew all that shit existed.
Right.
And that's why I was excited to see it. Because I am a lifelong Spider-Man fan. So Into the Spider-Verse was just kind of like hitting all these perfect notes for me that was like, yes, yes, yes. They got this character that I've loved for so long right. Right?
Mm-hmm.
He-Man and Masters of the Multiverse, written by Tim Seeley, feels like something that is written by someone like me about Spider-Man.
But a different fandom.
I didn't know any of that shit existed.
Yes, yes.
So it's really, really cool to see someone that, and we'll talk with Tim later about this,
yeah,
to see someone devote so much time and attention to getting this really widespread media property that fucking started as toys.
Yeah.
Right. And still make it appealing and digestible to someone that has no idea about He-Man like I do.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's fun to share in fandom, isn't it?
Yeah, I thought it was a really neat execution. It's very obviously Spider-Verse,
right?
But He-Man, but it's Spider-Verse Eternia,
which Tim says on this show.
He does, yeah. And we kind of talked around it because I didn't want to insult him.
Yeah,
but yeah, I mean, yeah, it hits all those same perfect, sweet, saccharine, funny notes. It's also got some really cool, slightly scary, badass stuff. I'm expecting a joke sometime soon about why Skeletor is buff.
Yeah.
And like, just the sheer concept of that existing in this book excites me.
Did you see Dan Slott's tweet this week or just a couple days ago now?
Maybe I did.
Yeah, he was like, why is Skeletor so buff? He's a skeleton.
Exactly. I bet he read the issue.
Yeah, probably.
Because I was like, they're totally going to start, you know, riffing. All that stuff, but in a loving way.
Yeah.
In a way that feels crafted by the people that really get He-Man.
Yeah. It's a fun issue. I liked it too.
Yeah. That's cool.
My second favorite book of last week was Gwenpool Strikes Back number 4 by Leah Williams and David Baldwin. This has been on my list before. I really love the meta fourth wall breaking comedy, and it's done really well here, especially when Christopher Hastings, the originator of Gwenpool, is in the second page, I think, as a cloud. Yeah.
He tweeted about it.
It's hilarious. Yeah. And you know, it's funny is when I was reading this series from the start, I was always like, I wonder if Christopher is annoyed Because, I mean, that was his baby for so long. But clearly not, because he's jumping in and doing a page. He's actually on the credits, too. It says that on the page.
Yeah, you love to see creators getting along, right?
Yeah, oh yeah.
That's awesome.
And I know Jordan White is a editor of this book. I think it's a book that he's fond of in his heart in particular. And, I mean, if you like comic books, and if you've read comic books your whole life, you're going to really like how this is not only a commentary on comic book events and comic books and superheroes and stuff like that, but it's just poking fun at the medium. And David Baldwin, oh my God, Williams puts him through the ringer. He has to draw some insane stuff where Gwenpool's actually climbing over classic covers and comic book art as if they're like cubes or walls. It's really cool. Looks great.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
What's your another one that I see why it exists as a comic?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Yeah. They keep playing up the fact that this is the last one. Like, they're kind of cancel Gwenpool forever, and I hope not. I hope it's selling well.
That just seems like meta commentary to me.
Yeah, it could be
such a good fit for this character. But
yes, for crazy. Sure. What's your favorite comic last week?
Speaking of comics that seem like they are about comics.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite book of last week is Olympia Number 1, written by Kurt Pierce with art by Alex Diotto. I spoke at length with Kurt about this comic, specifically the first issue, but we kind of touched on some later stuff as well.
Mm-hmm.
In a special episode of the AAPT Comics podcast that is on this feed. It's a great comic about the impact that comics and superheroism and wearing your morals on your sleeve, and even, you know, as specifically as people like Jack Kirby have on our lives and the things that we love and the things that we think are right and wrong. It follows a kid named Elon whose favorite comic book character, the Olympian, from a very Jack Kirby-esque world called Olympus, comes to life. He falls through a portal right into this kid's lap. They do some really, really great bits about how important comics are to Elon, how strange the medium of comics is in the real world. Like, the Olympian is hurt and he says, "Hail Vicodin."
Yeah, that was great.
You know?
Yeah.
And there's really, really great moments like that. And you can tell that it is so near and dear to Kurt's heart. Kurt is a friend of mine, and I really love to see him succeeding in this way. I think it's a really, really great comic that it just feels so warm and friendly and personable. And I know it's coming from a very deep-rooted, sentimental place, given that Kurt wrote it while his father was in the hospital for cancer treatment before his father passed away.
Yeah.
So when you know, very often I'm in favor of engaging with media without knowing the context necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it needs to stand on its own, but the context in this case strengthens this book so, so well. You know, this shared love and appreciation for comics that Kurt and his dad had. And also to see other creators kind of piling onto that, Alex and Micah Myers and D. Cuniff and stuff. It just really feels so intimate.
Mm-hmm.
I like it.
Nice. I actually reviewed it for AIPTcomics.com. Did you get to see that review? I don't know if you saw. I gave it a high score.
I did. Yeah, you did.
It reminds me of like Paper Girls you know, Stranger Things in a sense too, because it's suburban lifestyle and something crazy or magical happens.
Yeah.
I like that combo.
I only live about 2 hours from Olympia, Washington.
Oh, really?
Where the book is set. And I asked her about that. I was like, did you like take photos? Did you come to Olympia? Because it feels so right, that suburban foresty area.
I hope it sells well, because it feels like it could sell really well. I think audiences should like it a lot.
Yeah, I think people will like it when they get into it. I saw quite a few comic shops tweet out. I follow a lot of comic shops on Twitter.
Yeah.
And I saw like a lot of them tweet out that this was their pick of the week.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Good pick, buddy.
How about you?
Excalibur Number 2 by Teeny Howard and Marcus Toe is my favorite book of last week. I've not made it a secret that Excalibur is my favorite Dawn of X book. We talked about that last week, didn't we? Number 2 continues that trend for me. I really love how Apocalypse is being written, as well as Betsy Braddock. And the whole magic element is starting to come. It's starting to like become more complex and interesting. There are druids in the book. And the way Rogue is used is quite interesting as well. There's an interesting twist to it. I'm just so pumped for this book. I think it might be the prettiest book as well. Marcus Toh is doing a fantastic job. I'd love to have Teenie Howard on this show because we could ask her some great questions about this series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Teenie is my favorite creator that I did not know about before last year.
Interesting. Do you have other favorite creators that are sort of specific?
I could get that specific. We should do a weird show like that. Yeah.
My favorite creator who's never read written Deadpool or something like that. Yeah, totally check it out. I mean, it's kind of silly for me to even recommend it because everyone's probably going to read this anyway.
Yeah, I liked Excalibur and Marauders both this week. I did not like them as much as their first issues, and I just felt it was appropriate to talk about some different books this week, but I think they're both really great. Marauders, as you will see on social media, does have a coloring issue.
Yes.
The specifics of which I do not necessarily feel equipped to talk about as a white man.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some issues with the way Bishop and Storm and other characters are being colored, potentially inaccurately, very likely inaccurately. Whether or not that's ill-intended or not is a whole big, broad conversation that yes. we're not going to cover here.
X Twitter is very vocal about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would implore people to check that out, those concerns, because I think they're legitimate.
Yeah.
Even if you like Marauders, and I did like Marauders.
Yeah. And this has happened before where darker skinned characters are colored lighter for whatever reason, be it, I don't know, the use of light on the skin and stuff like that. It's kind of an interesting argument in that it's not something you immediately would think of, especially since a lot of these creators obviously aren't racist themselves, but it does create like a whitewashing issue.
Yeah. This is, again, I don't feel prepared to talk about this, and I don't know that it's appropriate for me to.
Mm-hmm.
You're right that it's not my default to read ill intention into what creators are making, but this Marvel has not responded now to two issues deep of complaints about the coloring of Marauders.
Yeah.
Artist, colorist, writer, editor, any of that. And that's just not a good look for building a sense of community around comics, I think.
Right, right. Especially for X-Men.
There are things that can really easily be put into different columns. There's like legitimate concerns and then like this whole other column that is like people that are upset that Dr. Doom is a bad guy because they like Dr. Doom
mm-hmm.
or something, right? And that second column of concerns, I get that those people are equally as vocal, and it could become a widespread response to just not respond to any of them.
Mm-hmm.
But there is very much a core group of very legitimate concerns, and I think that this coloring issue falls into that.
Mm-hmm.
Marauders is gay as hell, though. So on the flip side, I like that part.
And Dugan is very outspoken about that.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of things to be upset about right now, I think, including, in my opinion, the fact that Marvel 2099 is a thing again.
Is here.
They've yeah. brought back the line, and this week, Marvel 2099, like a sort of a, what is it? 2099 Alpha, right, is the name of it?
They've started doing these Alpha books for all event series.
Read this first, and then you'll get all the series. You'll understand what's going on. That debuted, Nick Spencer wrote it with art by Victor Brogdonovich, I think is his name.
Yes. Yep.
I reviewed it for APT Comics. Wasn't a fan. I then told Forrest, you got to read this. I wasn't a fan. And yeah. So what do you think? Why is okay, first of all, we already kind of know 2099 is coming back because of the whole, it's been what, like 70 years or something since, what is it? 30 years?
Oh, since... in 80 years, it will be...
Yeah. There's some weird math. So it's like kind of like an opportune time to bring it back. Miguel has been a character in Marvel Comics for the last couple of years, off and on.
And obviously, it's Into the Spider-Verse.
Yep. Maybe that's another reason.
They're sending some stuff up there, yeah.
I don't know. Why is this trending? Why is this happening?
I wish I knew, man. Alpha, like, the visuals were awesome.
Really good. Dark. Very dark.
Yeah. Very, very dark. Very unexpected. But this, we don't talk about this often, but I really have a problem with comics that are just like, I call it proper noun syndrome.
Yeah.
Where it's like, name of a place, name of a person, name of a thing, name of a disease, name of a gun, all back to back to back. It's like every other word on a page.
Yeah.
And I think it's very exposition heavy. But I also think writers are trying to do that to like ground you in a reality.
Right.
But people don't talk like that.
You need to show, not tell.
And this issue in particular is tasked with setting up the 2099 line as an alpha book.
Yeah.
And it just completely failed at that for me.
Yeah.
It didn't make an argument for 2099, the new event series, to exist.
Right.
I didn't know that one of the main characters was one of the main characters until the very last page where they revealed his name.
Yeah, yeah. That was confusing. The whole book was, I thought, organized poorly. How about this? I said this in my review. The first scene where we hear Watcher and Dr. Doom talking to each other, we don't actually see them. We see like a moon. And then like it takes like five panels to figure out that they're the ones talking to each other in the captions. Yeah. And I was like literally angry that it took that long for them to show me who was talking.
Yeah.
I didn't care one iota who was talking until I saw who it was. And also I didn't have the context to know who was talking. So like I couldn't understand like who was the bad guy, who was the good guy. And I don't think that was the intention. It was just like poorly like designed to like not even tell us who was talking until the last second.
Yeah, I think the problem with this book, and I'm glad that we're talking about this because we don't often get hard enough on books or concepts. It had these two extremes. The proper noun syndrome that I was talking about, which is like just not trusting the reader.
Yeah.
Like we have to tell them everything on one page. And then what you're talking about is the other extreme. You have no idea who's talking or what it's about or whatever. And they want to get this like gotcha moment or something by making it all click 20 pages deep. And that doesn't work. Like,
and to your Ghostwriter point, like the way that scene was laid out.
If you knew that was Ghostwriter, I will send you a fucking dollar.
Like I actually reread the book after I read it once. Because I started seeing visual things that I didn't necessarily notice. Like, he is on a motorcycle, Ghost Rider. But, like, it's not... There's no attention to the motorcycle. It's not, like, on fire or anything.
Yeah.
There's no detail to let you know who he is. And the way that part of the story lays out, we're introduced to a character that doesn't matter. And he's given all the attention.
Who's the focus?
Right. Yeah. So your focus is like, oh, it's this guy I should be paying attention to. And then this guy on a motorcycle shows up and et cetera, et cetera. And then eventually you realize at the last page, like Forrest just said, it gives you a snapshot of all the characters that were in this book that matter. And you're like, oh, that was, wait, what?
Right. Yeah.
It was a frustrating reading experience for me.
So it's a frustrating first issue.
Yeah.
I don't think it succeeded at all.
No.
In doing what
it needed to create buy-in, and all it did was make me want to tear up the book and not give any of them time of day.
So in a broader sense, when we're talking about the things that they're doing, they're flooding the market. We mentioned that as much this episode. But in a broader sense, did you get an idea of why 2099, the story, needs to exist right now?
Not right now, no. I think Dr. Doom, spoilers, he dies in Amazing Spider-Man, but then he's not dead. Anyway, there's an attack on Dr. Doom, which somehow connects to this. Mm-hmm. And we learn in this alpha issue that Doom wants to end all superheroes because they're basically dangerous. And
they think of themselves as gods.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Which we've seen that story 1,000 times. But
yeah.
Somehow Dr. Doom of now is connecting to then. I don't know.
There's also an argument that's supposed to be made, and this is maybe the most legitimate reason I see for the 2099 series existing.
Yeah.
There's an argument that is made that 2099 is the true future of the Marvel universe.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Like, Miguel says to Spider-Man that he's unavoidable, that there are alternate dimensions and timelines and characters and all that stuff, but everything leads to 2099.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like there's kind of maybe an editorial idea there to unify everything into a stricter timeline. They're kind of doing that over with the History of the Marvel Universe book as well.
Isn't this just going to be another story, though, where they're trying to change the future? Like, isn't that the point of it, kind of? just like Miguel was trying to change his own future when he went back in time. Yeah. It was in the 616, you know, not the 616, but when he was with Spider-Man.
Yeah. And that's, you just capitalized on the problem with it.
Yeah.
I get the idea that they're trying to unify all these books, especially like while Hawks and Pox are setting up the X-Men to be kind of at odds with all the other heroes in the universe, to have this like stricter timeline and marriage of things like Dr. Doom and Spider-Man, the Fantastic Four featuring a lot in 2099, Peter is eventually going to get to 2099, obviously. I get what they're trying to do, but like more explicitly tying Fantastic Four, Spider-Man, X-Men, all this shit together.
Yeah.
But, and it's probably because they're trying to set up some sort of like, now the character, a Civil War type situation. And it's crazy. We're just talking about event after event after event after event. I get why they're trying to do it, but if you want an example of how horrifically you can fail at that, this alpha issue is that.
I wasn't a super fan of the Fantastic Four issue that also came out this week, but I'm gonna give it the benefit of the doubt. Let me give you a hot take though. Instead of Marvel 2099 Alpha, they should have put out, hear me out, Moira 2099. Boom! I just sold a million comics. All the X-Men fandom would be like, what's going on with Moira? We need to read this book. I
True.
mean, yes, Marvel would be definitely like giving up their Moira card, right? Because whenever that series drops in 2020, and it will, it's going to blow people's minds, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But I doubt Hickman would ever let them do that.
I'm surprised that they resisted the urge to do that.
Could you imagine if there was a Moira 2099 and she just like kills herself and like, I'm
Yeah.
going to just erase all of this. Bye.
Yeah, I do think like you're not wrong. They are trying to tie stuff up
Yeah. I'm
to
very
each
curious to
other.
see when X-Men 2099 shows up, because there is going to be an X-Men 2099. It's got to be, right?
Yeah.
They should have led with that. That's what they should have done. With
They should have. Yeah, I mean, yeah. In any event, my hope for it is really deflated.
Yeah.
I was really, like defending Conan being in 2099
Now
when they
it
announced that.
doesn't make sense now. It's like, huh? Who cares?
Yeah, it just like,
I will say I really like Doctor Doom in it. That was my favorite scene
yeah,
after I figured
there
out
was
who
some
was
great,
talking.
there were some great visuals and some great tension between Uatu and Doctor Doom
And
that I thought was really interesting.
knowing that Chip Zdarsky is going to be writing the Doctor Doom book,
Yeah.
that I'm excited for that
Yeah.
too.
I have faith in certain books.
Yeah.
I would put it that way. But the overall thing, I just like, it's so muddied to me now in a way that I haven't seen an event comic be muddied
Yeah, it feels
in
either
a while.
slapped together or rushed. I don't know.
Yeah. And I liked talking about why we thought it needed to exist because I definitely didn't get a sense.
Why did Absolute Carnage need to exist? In our next segment, top books for next week, we talk
Yeah,
about
get me out of here.
our number one favorite book that's coming out. And I picked Basketful of Heads number two. I cheated because I've already read it. And it's written by Joe Hill with art by
It's
Leo Max.
good.
So I think I might have mentioned this on a previous show. We got to read issue one and two when we got to interview Joe Hill a couple weeks ago. And I argued at that time they should have just released one and two as issue one as an extra size, because issue one does a great job setting up the characters. There's some fantastic character acting in there, great visuals, telling you a story on top of the story. But issue number two picks things up. That's where it becomes like a slasher, horror, scary comic book. And
The type of thing you would expect from Joe Hill.
yeah, I mean, issue
Yeah.
one, great setup. Issue two, all action, all scary, all like twists and turns. And the very last page totally starts to pull together what this series is really about. And
Yes.
that's why it's my top book for next week. I'm really excited to see people's reaction, because if you liked issue one, you're gonna love issue two, likely.
Yep, I liked it. I liked it a lot.
What is your most anticipated book out next week?
My most anticipated book out next week is New Mutants number two. I feel that this book has the strongest sense of character and purpose out of, well, Marauders has a really good sense of purpose. It's a great problem to have that you're like, oh, but Excalibur does this, but Marauders does this, but New Mutants does this. New Mutants has the strongest characters to me. That's probably because I'm already invested in those characters, but my God, the art is beautiful too. Even just the cover for this issue. Like, I'm just so excited about the direction that Hickman and Brisson and Rodriguez are taking this book in right now.
Yeah.
It's really endearing.
If I were to believe in heaven, I'd like it to look like that.
Yeah, man. I have concerns about this book falling off when Hickman leaves.
Yes. Well,
But right now, like, I like the idea that you can tell he's so invested in it
technically,
because.
Ed Brisson is the main writer because his name comes first.
Yeah,
At least it was on
sure.
issue one, for all I know. He
Yeah.
might be second on the issue two. Cool. So, are you done?
Yeah.
Are you done?
Yeah, I'm done. It's a good book.
In our next segment, Judging by the Cover, Junior, we talk about our favorite cover art out next week, which is also displayed as the feature on this podcast, as well as the feature on the AIPTcomics.com post, which you can also see the covers in full if you go to that website and you go to this post and you look and you scroll down, you look at it, you look at the covers. What's your favorite cover art out next week?
My favorite cover out next week is Supergirl Annual number 2. The cover art is by Jonathan Glapion and Victor Bogdanovic.
Oh, he didn't he just do 2099 Alpha?
Yeah, busy dude.
Yeah.
This is a really kind of dark, foreboding cover. Mm-hmm. Depicts Supergirl in shadow with the red S is very highlighted, but the rest of her is kind of this matte black. And it goes up to this, her face is concealed by the Batman Who Laughs mask. Her hair is falling around it, and she just has this kind of like gaping maw of a mouth, dirty white teeth against like void blackness. And then in the background, you have this really like, it is the antithesis to complementary colors. Like this green is like offensive to the eye, mm-hmm. and with this like ha 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 splattered all around it. And it just feels so forced and alien and foreign in a way that is evocative of why the Joker works, for sure, that this ha 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 cover will get that. But also, like, the way Batman Who Laughs is, it just feels so, like, wrong when you look at it and so intentionally designed to feel that way. I like it. It's neat.
That's the same way I feel whenever I see any clown at all, actually. This is wrong. It's wrong. My favorite cover comes from X-Force number 2. I believe it's a variant cover by Gerardo Zevino, and it is wild. It's beastly. It's got Wolverine with his claws popped. He appears to be loving it, even though blood is being splattered all over his brown costume. Beast is behind him, clearly, like, killing, maiming people. and everything behind them is cast in red, the figures behind them, I should say, which is like mm-hmm. an axe and just all out chaos and war. I love how thick Wolverine's forearms are. It's very animalistic. These two are just having the times of their lives going full beast mode, feral mode, and I love it. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I think it's neat. It's like a crazed Bill Sienkiewicz cover.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's like a roughness to the art that definitely feels Sienkiewicz-y. Yeah, you're right. So those are our favorite covers. Next up, we are going to be talking to Tim Seeley and Dan Fraga about He-Man and the Masters of the Multiverse number 1. That's out already. You can go pick that up at your comic shop or on comixology.com. And we get into it. Enjoy. On the show, we have Tim Seeley and Dan Fraga, who are coming out with He-Man and the Masters of the Multiverse number 1 this week. I'm sure many, many fans of He-Man are excited for this one, in particular because of the multiverse part, but we'll get to that. Thank you so much for being on the show, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Our pleasure.
So right off the bat, what are your backgrounds and relationship with He-Man? I know, Tim, I know you wrote Injustice vs. Masters of the Universe, but I'm just curious, did you guys grow up with He-Man? Did you watch it as a kid?
Yeah. I mean, I wrote the book on He-Man because I'm such a nerd about it, so I grew up with it. I have two brothers, and we lived in the country, and there's nothing to do except beg my mom to buy us He-Man guys.
Nice.
Yeah, I was a fan, mostly peripherally from my little brother's perspective, because I'm, you know, I watched the show, but right around then I was more growing into junior high and you know, looking at girls.
Right.
Hey, He-Man had girls in it.
Yeah, it did.
That's true.
It sure did.
Yeah, one or two.
And then I would say the other connection with He-Man is that I worked at Mattel for 5.5 years.
Oh wow.
And working on what?
I was a supervising director on a lot of their animated content: Monster High, Ever After High, Max Steel, Polly Pocket. So just taking care of those things. A lot of girl stuff, but also some Hot Wheels and Max Steel.
Awesome. That's awesome. Thanks. It's a very underappreciated part of the comics market, I think, is that a lot of people are also animators.
Right.
So as Dave alluded to before, this is a Masters of the Multiverse series. And we wanted to ask you guys why you think we're seeing so many iterations of the multiverse story recently. There's Stephen King and Joe Hill dipping into this big horror multiverse. There's some multiverse happening, obviously, over in Spider-Man, a couple other places right now. Does it just feel like the right time for these types of stories?
I mean, I think it's because we've finally trained the audience to be as nerdy as comic book readers.
Because it, that's funny.
I mean, it used to be that you'd have the way the multiverse came around was just so that you could justify a crossover between JSA and JLA, or you know, and that was totally a comic book thing, right? Because they had different publishers and they'd renamed characters and they had two Flashes. So like, well, how do we explain this? Oh, there's a multiverse. There's more than one Earth. And that's been a conceit in comics for years. But now that you've had Marvel movies for 10 years, like you can now, and DC TV shows for the same amount of time, you can get away with stuff you couldn't get away with before, or at least like executives are saying, yeah, the audience gets things now. Like I think before, you know, if you'd done the Batman 89 movie and then the sequel was a multiverse story, people would be like, what the hell? And it just wouldn't work. But I think, you know, we've trained everybody up.
Mm, that makes sense. Have you guys been planning the this He-Man series for a while?
Not really. I mean, I wish that's how it worked. It's kind of, you know, it's like we had talked to Mattel about doing a new series, and they had a couple ideas for what they wanted. And then, you know, with their plans, it worked out really well to do this. And they kind of said, they'd asked me, like, well, what would you do if you could have every He-Man in the same story? And then I had to come up with a story. But it's only like, you know, it takes like a month or two when you're working with Mattel and DC before you start working. So, you know, I mean, in my head, I've been playing with these toys forever. So I guess in that way, it's been in development for 42 years. But
42 years in the making.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's interesting. I mean, with the multiverse, you can dip into different mediums. Are any of the characters you're using, do they exist in other media other than, say, the cartoon?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's the movie He-Man, Dolph.
Right.
Dolph Lundgren He-Man is in there. A video game He-Man is in there.
Yeah.
And the mini comics He-Man is important to the story. Cartoon He-Man. We use the new toys that Sideshow designed. I mean, I sent Dan a link for a Bollywood musical He-Man. I'm like, we're gonna.
Whoa! I did not know that existed.
It does.
It looks awesome.
Are there? You must be creating your own too, then.
So far we have. I mean, there's no reason to really like. I mean, for me, it's there's so much to play with. There's no reason to like add to it with if you know, because I would just be adding something new that people they haven't seen. Why not give them something that they might have affection for and have a connection to? So yeah, but I mean, and Anti-He-Man, who is our bad guy, is an existing character too. He was in a German audio play, which is really obscure, but
it's
like
a deep cut, yeah,
yeah. But it was made, you know. I mean, I think everybody sort of recognized how cool it looked, and he's been part of the toy mythos since the classics relaunch. So he just had never gotten a story. I was like, that's a character we need to use. Like, there's something really cool about. A reverse, you know, all black, red-haired He-Man.
I love that. I don't want to spoil it, but I also love the tagline he uses. Is that from the play?
Yeah, the Hell Skull. Yeah.
Awesome.
Somebody translated it, and they translated it as that, and I always thought that is so cool and had to be used.
Yeah, it's really awesome. It really locked in that childhood feeling for me. How did the team design the visuals for each multiverse? Some of them are really Kirby-esque. Others are very obviously classic He-Man. And others are, like, towards the end there, like, even, like, G.I. Joe-style appearances. Are those all just cribbing directly from the media they're from? Or did you write into the script or have discussions about how to mash up all those visual styles?
I mean, that's one for you, Dan. I try to give you as much existing stuff as possible, so you don't have to.
Yeah. So what I did, like for Sideshow, I really looked at the Sideshow stuff and the level of detail that they had, and then for the video game style, I just try to match that style as much as possible. And then when we came to Anti-Eternia, because there hadn't really been an established style. I just kind of went with my default way of drawing. And then later on when we got to New Adventures, we kind of reached a fork in the road of, do we draw it to look like the cartoon or do we draw it to look like the toys? Mm. So I wanted to focus on making it look like the toys. And that's what I did moving forward for that. And the 2000 He-Man is really just trying to, the 2000 He-Man, I wanted to match some of the proportions and things from the show, but really wanted to also give tribute to the toys because I feel like the toys had more detail and are more exciting. And then for the Filmation stuff, it's going to look like Filmation because of the fact that it's so the iconography that comes with the Filmation look going to go with that.
This is a very unique challenge you're kind of undertaking, having to mix all these medias into a comic book, isn't it?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think everybody has to kind of take a bit of the burden. Like Tim is writing this stuff to feel very much like, you know, the vernacular and grammar, the aesthetics of the grammar are very much in line with the universes that they're in. You know, Skeletor talks like Skeletor from that realm. And, and then, you know, I'm penciling a certain way. When Rich is inking, he's inking a certain way. And when Matt Yackey, our colorist, is coming in, he's doing his best to match the vibes and feeling of all those things as well. So it's really a team effort.
That's awesome. So He-Man started as a property very much for children, but naturally these kids are now adults. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, fitting the book to the right audience without losing that spirit?
I mean, that's the toughest part because the people who read comic books are generally older and generally more jaded. And so the job for me is I'm not going to write like a super dark Filmation He-Man character. It's just not right. Which means he has to make one-liners that will make your eyes roll, but that's the point, right? So it has to be in spirit. Like I'm not going to darken that part up, but the overall story has to be more sophisticated, in quotes. I would put that in quotes because I'm not sure that just aging these things up makes them more sophisticated, but I think there is sort of an expectation of that. We have to make this really cool and really fun, and it has to celebrate the character. And that means it's okay to, you know, dive deep into nostalgia and to play with the things that, you know, may seem sort of silly but or dated, but you just update them and you know, treat them with respect and treat the characters with the respect they deserve too.
Is there any He-Man or non-He-Man media that made an influence on that kind of story development and the characters, movies, books, other comics?
I mean, it's pretty clear that we were influenced by Spider-Man into the Spider-Verse, right? I mean, like, that's part of this is that we even make a slight acknowledgement in there where we have Keldor do some graffiti. You know, it's like we have to just at least sort of mention that this is... yeah, we're wearing our... Because obviously the inspiration for this was, you know, saying, wait, there's a bunch of Spider-Mans and people really liked it and they got it. Like, and then they say, well, we have a ton of different He-Mans and we're trying to explain how they go together. Like, why not do a similar idea? Which is obviously, you know, Spider-Verse didn't invent that either. That goes, like I said, goes back to, you know, JLA, JSA kind of stuff. But we definitely were like, we'll lean into that a little bit and let that be, you know, part of the story.
Do you guys have a favorite issue in the run or a moment, say? No spoilers, of course, but...
I have a specific character that I like. Mm-hmm. This is completely out of spoilersville. I really enjoy drawing Skeletor in every iteration. I love him. And as a kid, his cackle always brought me joy. And just his voice. So even it doesn't matter if it's Space He-Man or 2000X He-Man or Sideshow He-Man, he still sounds like Filmation He-Man to me in my head when I'm drawing him. So I just have a doozy of a time doing it.
I think issue two is like just an all around issue two really works because I was of all the Master Universe iterations, the one I was least familiar with was New Adventures, which is the toy line that came out like at the end of the 80s, early 90s. It's basically He-Man space. And it's not as well loved, I guess, maybe by fans, and it doesn't have as much of impact on pop culture. But for some reason, when we did the comic of it, like I suddenly got it. It all came together for me, and I really liked working it. And the way Dan draws those characters, it makes it, I don't know, like I saw all this potential in Space He-Man.
That's awesome.
What was the research process like for finding those different mediums? Like, I think I could Google He-Man all day and not find an obscure German play.
Yeah, that's true.
I just know this stuff. I mean, I've been involved in Masters of the Universe fandom since, like, I mean, you know, there was like 5 years there where I didn't, like between 13 and 18, where I didn't really deal with Masters of the Universe stuff. And then I was back. Like, I just, you know, I was buying the old comics and collecting the figures. And I joined He-Man.org in 1999. Like, the first time I got the internet, it was the first website I think I joined. Was it 2000, 1999, somewhere in there. So for me, this is just, I knew these things existed pretty, like, I mean, I didn't have to do any research, really. The only thing I had to research was, is I had to rewatch the, and some, for some of it, I had to watch them for the first time, the Space He-Man stuff. Because I, again, like I said, it, you know, it came out when I was a little bit older. And, but I had all the DVDs. I just hadn't watched it all. So, but for me, like, I mean, you know, I did the Art of He-Man book. So my brother and I spent 6 months, you know, researching this then. And if you've ever seen my basement, which is a entire wall of classic figures, like, I've been doing research for a long time.
I wanted to ask, do you have any, like, very strange merchandise that nobody has or anything?
Oh, indeed. Oh. I mean, I've got all kinds of weird stuff, but I got a lot of cool knockoff stuff. There's a lot of stuff from other countries that I really like.
Oh,
I have nice. Wonder Bread He-Man, which is the rumored to exist but never confirmed He-Man giveaway, which had black armor and brown hair, but I have one.
Nice.
And they're super rare. And I have Masters of the Universe chew toys for dogs. I have all kinds of weird stuff that I've
You have made. a lot of stuff from south of the border too.
Yeah, a lot of Mexico stuff. Because when we go to Masters of the Universe convention called PowerCon, and Dan got to go for the first time this year. I've been going.
Which was so cool.
And there's a lot of fans in South America and Mexico, and I trade them drawings for the international Masters of the Universe stuff. So I've got, like, you know, weird blow mold He-Mans and Mexican Manny faces and all kinds of nerdy stuff that I could talk about for a long time, but I won't, because.
Okay, Tim, how many tattoos do you have? How many He-Man tattoos? Tell us.
Not a one, thank God. I never went there, but it probably was, you know, there's a couple of symbols that I could have easily picked for a tattoo at some point in there.
So speaking of toys and merchandising, like, outside of comics and movies and stuff, obviously the toys are a huge part of He-Man, and all the other media is kind of bespoke made for the toy line. Was there a specific toy that made you, in the vein of that Netflix show, The Toys That Made Us? Was there the one He-Man toy that you really liked as a kid, or do you remember what got you into it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, for me, it was when I was 5 years old, I got the set. It was He-Man plus Battle Cat plus a mini comic. It was like before the cartoon and everything. And I was just in love with it. I thought it was the most, I mean, in the box, painting on it by, I think it was Rudy or William George, one of the two guys painted the box art on the back. And it's just like, it looked like hard fantasy to me. I didn't know that it was, you know, going to be eventually more kids friendly, but, like, it just looks scary and weird. And I still have my original, my 37-year-old He-Man and Battle Cat set.
Yeah, awesome. I was a big fan of any toy that had extra stuff. Like, I like Cyclone because he could spin around, and I like the I don't know what you call it, when, you know, the, when you twist that thing and then the image changes. You know, the, like, his chest had that, like, radar image on it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then I also I liked Moss Man a lot because he smelled like pine. And I liked Web Store because he could climb up stuff. And I thought the grappling hook was really cool.
To this day, my brother and I think the best He-Man figure of all time is Faker. And he's just the blue and orange He-Man. But we both say that that color scheme and that figure kind of formed our aesthetics for design and art, you know? Because it's like, you know, these complementary colors or... and it's just like such a weird figure and it's so cool. And the idea that it's supposed to be an imposter He-Man, like how would that work? But yeah, that figure is so cool.
Tim, if DC Comics came to you and were like, we want to do something like House of X, Powers of 10, Dawn of X with He-Man, which supporting characters do you think could support their own books?
Oh man, that's, well, Skeletor for sure. And
yeah.
I think, I mean, that's kind of the thing we're learning about this book is that Keldor, the sort of proto Skeletor, is a pretty interesting character by himself, because he's sort of this guy who is corrupted and I think that's pretty interesting. But he's also like he's kind of an arrogant, impatient guy to begin with. But I think you could get away with doing a Teela book for sure. Teela's awesome, and obviously She-Ra, which is kind of its own thing.
Right.
But, I don't know, man. I could definitely get into, you know, like some kind of group of Master Universe characters, like they get lost on the other side of the planet and so they're stuck in this weird fantasy thing that we haven't seen yet. Like you do kind of a barbarian version. I could have some fun with it. I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice. I don't know why, but Orko always reminds me of Dupe or maybe the other way around.
Well, he starts from X-Men. The long tradition of, you know, we have this kind of semi-serious thing, so we need a comedic relief that we can make plush toys out of, you know? It's like comes from that. I mean, this goes back to, you know, Blue Falcon having Dino Mutt and all, you know, it's always been a thing. He totally comes from Batmite. That's where Orko comes from, right? Like,
oh, yeah, true.
Yeah. Or Mr. Mitzelplitz or, you know, that kind of character.
Mm.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the end of our interview portion. In our next segment, Super Fight, this is where we have two characters fight, but we play the game Super Fight and pull a card to randomly have them compete in the most absurd competitions, like best lumberjack, say. So I'm going to randomly pick two characters. First, Beast Man versus Orko. And the card is Beauty Pageant. Who would win in a beauty pageant?
Beast Man.
Yeah, it'd Beast
Man. You think?
Because Orko, we don't know what his face looks like. But all we know is
But there's so much mystery.
Yeah, all we know is that it's weird.
Yeah, but it's Beast Man he's going to have that Vidal Sassoon makeover that you give people, like when you see those girl movies. Like, he's going to have that, and he's going to have bows. Kind of like the Cowardly Lion.
Yeah. And,
Wizard of Oz. It's gonna be so lustrous and smell so good. Yeah, I think he's gonna win.
Yeah, if you condition that fur, it's gonna be very, very beautiful.
Yeah.
Plus, he's got the whip. It's vaguely threatening.
Yeah. Better bow for me. And right. whips can be beautiful too, depending on the situation.
Oh boy, Forrest, do you have any thoughts on this one?
I want to say Orko just because we don't know what's going on.
Yeah,
but
mystery.
I feel like that's, you know, like it could be the total meet cute where he turns around and pulls his hat off and you're like, oh shit, you know.
Yeah,
when
no
the girl
wonder.
Finally takes her glasses off in the movies and all that kind of stuff.
Right. That makes sense. All right. There we go. In our next segment, Off Topic Top Shelf, this is our last segment. Just wondering what you guys are into right now that's not comics related.
You want to go with this one, Tim?
I mean, the only thing, like, and it is comics related, but my wife and I are watching the new Watchmen show on HBO.
But I
didn't really want to like it, but it's fantastic, and I totally recommend it to everybody. It's the thing that I've never seen anyone pull off successfully, where it's a sequel, but it's just and it's loaded with connections to the comic books, but you don't need to. It's just like tonally a perfect sequel. It's really good.
Yeah, I've been reviewing it for AIPT Comics, and I really like it. Last week we had Mike Carey and Peter Gross on, and that actually came up. And Peter was telling us like he feels really awkward watching it because he knows like Alan Moore's not like supporting it and whatnot. We talked about that a bit.
Yeah. Yep. It is a whole thing, but it is masterfully done.
I will say I like it a lot too, and it feels like the first time they have all those like Rorschach's journals and other like special ops info and stuff that they're producing outside of the show. And it's really felt like the first. Yeah, it's all on the HBO website. And it really feels to me like the first time that information is essential or enriching to the show. You know, like when they promote Godzilla movies and stuff, they make websites that track Godzilla moving through the ocean and stuff. And I'm like, yeah, it's cute. But the depth and the understanding of the content with which they're producing really, I think, enriches both the show and the comic in a really interesting way.
Yeah, adds to it.
Dan, what are you digging? You're just mostly working, as I understand.
Yeah, I'm actually working right now. I've recently taken up sculpting. With using Super Sculpey, and it's been helping the drawing. And then the other thing I've been trying to study is social economics and what makes things stick and how things go viral and how algorithms work and things like that. I'm kind of a nerd in that way. Whenever I get into something, I get really heavy into it.
Do you use that to apply? Do you apply that to your comics creation?
I do. In fact, when talking about He-Man and promoting it and things like that, I try to use all of the techniques that I can employ to get as many people on board as possible. But it's not just comics related. But yeah, that's the thing. I do a nightly YouTube stream that's all about comics and the creation of comics. So,
oh, cool. It's under, like a live one?
A live one every night at 9 p.m. Eastern. It's called Couch Doodles. And I get guests. Like last week I had Brian Stegman on, and the week before that I had Art Tiber. This week I'm going to have a newcomer, a guy named Rob Willis, who's got a new book called Shinobi Sasquatch coming out. So I've got, they just talk about the creation of comics and people's pathways into getting into comics. It's a lot of fun. I'm going to have Tim on there too.
One of these days.
It's got to happen sooner than later. That's for sure.
Yeah. Anytime, buddy.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, thank you guys so much for being on the show, Tim, Dan. This was a blast. This was fun.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, appreciate it very much.